to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Willis.
Yes.
What is today? November. Oh, I got it right today. November 17th. I put the page together almost always. I put Saturday's date instead of Sunday's date. What the heck is wrong with me? So what are we, 10 days into Trump's Great America? Maybe. Did have somebody, might have been a neighbor, said that my Trump flag was an atrocity. Take it down.
Take it down.
It is an atrocity. Which, I don't know, I kind of thought was funny. I contemplated leaving it up forever. And, well, you know, thought better of it. Didn't want to be a complete pain. But anyway, it's kind of exciting. There's a lot happening, and it hasn't even started yet. So we're looking forward to that. Thought it made sense to have Fred Dasmalchi and Hamid Azimi back with us. We have done programs with them about Iran in the past, but gosh, and I listed them. Where did I list them? We started doing shows way back, August of 2015. So we have been doing shows with these guys for a long time. We've only done a few, but they are part of the Organization of Iranian American Communities. And it's just, I think it's something that maybe we don't know a lot about. I think most Americans don't follow this very closely. It's kind of like Iran bad. But there's a whole community within the outside, well, and inside, I guess, both inside and outside their country, that really is looking to promote freedom and get back to the values they had before. They're kind of captives at the moment. Hamid Azimi is the communications director for the Iranian American Community of Northern California. It's IAC NorCal, and I've got the links up there for their Facebook page and Twitter. That I just don't like calling X because, I don't know, it just seems like Twitter to me.
It's X.
I don't seem to be able to modernize. And Fred I see all the time. I just saw him a couple weeks ago. He's a resident of Sacramento, has been a human rights activist for over 30 years. He was arrested once in 1980 in the city of Mossad. After that, he was forced to leave the country. He increased his human rights activities to be the voice of the people in his country. He's been active in his community, mobilizing the Islamic community in Sacramento against Islamic fundamentalism in Iran. And he's a good friend of ours, and we see him regularly. And they had an event yesterday. I posted that as well. It was the Rally for Free Iran. It was everywhere, so I'll let them tell us all about it. But I did post the flyer for it. So if you were thinking that this is a one-dimensional thing, actually be prepared to be impressed. There's a whole nother side to this. So I don't know where you guys would like to start, but...
Well, let's start with our hellos and appreciation to you and Bill for having us on the program again.
Oh, sure.
And you're absolutely right. There's a lot to talk about, and we are honored to be guests of your show for this.
We're really... really happy to give you the time. This isn't something that lends itself to a 2-minute interview. It kind of has to be explained. So we have not spoken with you. I cannot believe this, but when I was putting the page together yesterday, April of 2022, a lot has happened since April of 2022. So I don't know how much you want to start forward and go back, or go back and come forward, or you tell us.
Well, I guess let Fred say hello to you, and then we'll tackle this. Fred, go ahead.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you so much for inviting us. It's an honor to be, you know, with you today, and I hope it will be helpful today. And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We, you know, this platform lends itself well to things that have to be explained kind of in long form. So we really appreciate you guys making the time on a Sunday afternoon to come on and educate us. A lot of times we see the world through a very narrow lens, and I don't believe our we'll call it news, but I think we all have other assessments for that. I think our news doesn't always do a very good job of giving us a full picture. So we really, we're really looking forward to hearing what you guys have to tell us about all of this.
I appreciate that, Aaron. And let me just start by a little general background on what we call the Iranian resistance. the movement in Iran by the people who have taken to the streets in, gosh, I think it's been 7 nationwide uprisings in the last 6-7 years. And this is a nation that is, or a country, I should say, that is situated right in the middle of a lot of things that are happening around it in the Middle East. Geopolitically, it's a piece of land that throughout the history, a lot of, you know, fight has been over it and control over it, mostly by the dictators, has been, you know, the topic of a lot of back and forth in the international arena. Fast forward to where we are right now, the Iranian regime rose up in 1979 so that they could get rid of a monarchic dictatorship. The last Shah of Iran was toppled, and more than anything, because of the dictatorship, because all of the, you know, elite and progressive students were imprisoned by the dictator, by the last Shah. And because that very last Shah of Iran was providing a lot of support for the Ayatollahs, for the religious people in the country, it ended up that those same religious leaders who, and I should not even, you know, call the religious leader, the fundamentalists, the Islamic fundamentalists that were in the corner of mosques back then in Iran, they had a lot of support from the system. And when the revolution happened, lo and behold, they were the pretty much the only group that had the organization and the internal network to take over the revolution. And they did that immediately after 1979 revolution. They managed to start their own army, which is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It doesn't even have the name of Iran after it, because they believe that the fundamentalists, that they own everything in the world and they need to destroy everything and take over. So the people of Iran ended up being at the center of an Islamic fundamentalist movement that started back then. If you look back, a lot of countries started having these backward Islamic fundamentalist movements in them. And fast forward right now, you know, going the 2 years back or a year and a half back, we see that the same talk of fundamentalism is wreaking havoc in the Middle East, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis in Yemen, and on and on and on. They are causing a lot of problems. And when it comes to what we have been talking about, you mentioned, Aaron, that the first talk with our group started in 2015. And I know back then, we, and right now, we have been talking about what is the alternative to the Ayatollahs. Is there a group, an Iranian group, that is ready, capable, willing to pay the price and bring about democracy in Iran, so that when we in the West, you know, imagine a Middle East that the Ayatollahs are not there anymore, and in Iran there is a democratic system which is not at war with everybody, which does not want to destroy any country in the Middle East, which wants to abolish the death penalty and abide by all the international laws. We've been talking about for many years about the alternative, which is the National Council of Resistance of Iran. As you mentioned, the mainstream media doesn't talk about it a whole lot because, you know, the policy in the West has been appeasing the Ayatollahs and not punishing the Ayatollahs for what they have done. And we can you know, talk about this appeasement for hours and give examples, but in a general term.
Well, Hamid, for those people, it occurs to me that for those folks who really don't know, because I remember we didn't really know, before the fundamentalists took over, kind of what did your, we've got like 3 minutes before the break, but kind of a snapshot of what the country looked like before. Because I remember just being so surprised. I guess I never took any history of that part of the world or anything beyond where the countries were located. But we didn't really look into what was going on in those places. How did the country function before these guys showed up?
Well, on that subject, if we are going to break in 3 minutes, I would need more time.
I know. We can come back with it after,
right.
But...
Yeah, let's come back to it. Let me just finish this, this first segment by just going, you know, finishing up the thoughts about the alternative to the Ayatollahs, because right now we can definitely go back and talk about how it was before. But right now, the Iranian issue, which was the Iranian people's issue with the Ayatollah, has become everybody's issue right now, especially post October 7th of last year. And everybody knows that we need to deal with it. And the alternative, which is the National Council of Resistance of Iran, led by a woman, Maryam Rajavi. She is in exile in Paris. And she is, ironically, the person who, in the Parliament of Europe, if I'm not mistaken, in 2015, warned the entire world that the danger of the Ayatollahs is not their nuclear bomb danger. The danger is their involvement in the Middle East spreading fundamentalism. Back then, I know we had talked about it in your show before, and we have been talking about it for many years. And up until, you know, October 7th, the world did not realize that the danger of the Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran is not necessarily just, you know, the regime getting their hand on the atomic bomb. I mean, they need to be stopped, and people of Iran will stop them with toppling the regime. But the world is now realizing that the main danger is the spread of Islamic fundamentalism and what the Iranian regime refers to as the export of revolution that they have done, which is basically export of their type of backward Islamic fundamentalism that is ruining the Middle East right now and has spread into other parts of the world, including South America.
And that seems to be where we all really tuned in. News of the world has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And now we have a lot more sources, some good, some bad. But we have things from inside those countries, outside those countries. We have a lot wider vantage point. The problem is we don't always know what happened before. So context is missing oftentimes. And I think that if we all went out and asked people, hey, did you know that there was a revolutionary group inside Iran that wants to get rid of the mullahs and fix things and be a democracy? People would be like, what?
Yeah, most people don't know.
They would not know, which is terrible. And that's why I think it's really important that you have rallies and things inside this country. And I know we'll talk about that, too. But I would like to sketch for people kind of what your country looked like. I've looked at before and after pictures, and it's amazing, and it's got to be heartbreaking for all of you. We will be right back with our guests. Hamid Azimi and Fred Dasmalchi. We are talking about the people of Iran as they rise up for freedom. You're here at We the People Radio, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, now back to the real Iran. What did it really look like before?
Well, before the 1979 revolution, we were under a different type of dictatorship. And that type of dictatorship was the monarchy, the Shah's dictatorship. When people looked at how it was, they saw a country that was going through being catapulted from the agrarian or the land lords to capitalism. That in itself, you know, when we look at how societies in the Middle East should be evolving, that's definitely one of the more common paths, that, you know, the landlords, you know, go to automation, and through the process of natural evolution of the society, they evolve into capitalism. But what happened in Iran was that the Shah basically, with the help of foreign powers, including the Kennedy and then the administrations after that, managed to topple the government of an Iranian nationalist called Mohammad Mossadegh. In 1953, he had nationalized Iranian oil, taken the oil out of the control of the British, and wanted to have a democracy in the Middle East with the type of national capitalism that our country needed to have. And he was the person who was basically leading Iran into its national growth into capitalism. But what happened with the 1953 coup d'etat, and then after that with Shah traveling to Washington and receiving instructions from President Kennedy that he needs to do a land reform, the type it was done in South America, to basically push everything to capitalism. But that in itself was, in Iran, was not the right path for the country. It was too soon, and it basically ruined our agriculture, forced millions of people who lived in the villages where there was or agricultural fields that they were taking care of, or agriculture, into big cities, forcing them to become factory workers for the new capitalist system. And because of that push, because of that untimely push, our agriculture got destroyed, and there was, in the society, there was signs of modernism, but underneath that facade, people were not happy with what was going on, and dissent started at that point. Shah's answer was building prisons. The two of the most vicious prisons that we have in the capital, Evin Prison and Ghazal Hisar Prison, which are the, you know, torture places for the kids right now in Iran, were built by the Shah to control the population. And that was pretty much the start of, you know, the new wave of dictatorship he had. He ended up canceling or abolishing the two parties that both of them were loyal to him. He abolished both of the political parties and started a single party system in Iran. And that added to the problems that people had with him. So when people look at Iran prior to 1979 revolution, they see the signs of a society that has been pushed into capitalism. They see a society that seems like it is doing okay, but they don't see the fact that at the same time, Iran had become a single party system. There was no other parties allowed to become a voice of any type of opposition to the Shah. And that, again, was one of the main reasons that people were fed up with his regime and his system, and they ended up, you know, revolting against him and putting a definite end to monarchy in Iran, which carried on to, you know, last couple of years, especially 2 years ago when we had Mahsa Amini uprising in Iran. One of the main chants that people had was that down with the oppressor, be it the Shah or the leader, referring to the current leader of Iran.
Yeah, and when you look, like, from the outside looking in, when you look just at pictures of women in the pre-revolution time and now, I mean, they just wore regular clothes like we do back then, and now there's
absolutely. But what those pictures do not show, Aaron.
Yeah, no,
both women, either in, you know, with no hair covering and with Western clothing, and the ones that we see with, you know, the so-called Islamic clothing, they are both suffering under a single-party system in a country that deserves to have democracy.
Right. Well, and it's got to be, I mean, it's got to be extremely difficult to fight them from inside Iran, but from outside, you're a worldwide movement. Like, your big conference is always, maybe they're just the ones that Fred sends me email about, but aren't they usually, like, in Paris? Or was that just one?
No, they are. Let me let Fred take that one, please.
Before that, I would like to mention about my experience during the Shah time. I mean, of course, the economy was doing better compared to what we have right now. I mean, there was some improvement, but overall, you know, it was a dictatorship. And I remember in 1975, I was a student in India, Iranian student in India. And that time, you know, the Savak was very powerful in Iran. And when I was in India, we have a demonstration against Iranian government, and practically Indian government let us as a foreign student to cover our face and attend demonstration, because we didn't be identified by the Savage. And that Savage was causing a lot of fear during the short time. And then what happened, President Carter, you know, he was pushing, and like 2-3 years before revolution, he was pushing for reform in Iran again, and asked Shah to not to push, you know, not to stop the Savage. But what didn't realize that by you know, 2 years before revolution, by not having Savage that strong, that is going to cause vacuum and start uprising. And once the practically Shah stopped torturing, you know, stopped in the prison, that caused especially in the movement start from the students actually against the Shah. And then from the student, you know, it went to the other cities, you know, because when they go back to the student, they went back to their cities and then practically become more active. And then practically in that time, people, they want to have a better system. But unfortunately, what happened, the mullah people, this religion people, they have a lot of freedom during the short time. And there was so much practically money during the short time was investing to give more vote for these mullah people, and they are the one who practically control the, you know, practically they hijack the revolution. And so, you know, people, they fight for democracy, but supreme leader, you know, in that time, you know, it was Khomeini, and practically he changed everything. And then practically he go forward, and then this is what we have right now. And I just want to mention, this is also, but this is what I saw, you know, what during the short time.
Now, it's important for that perspective, because otherwise it's easy to believe that things have been the same just since it's a little bit like coming in late in a movie, you know. We tuned in late and we think it was always like it is now. And that's just not true.
Go Hamid, thank you.
I broke the show, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Come back, Hamid, come back, save me.
So I think going back to what you asked about our movement being a international one. Let's just focus on that. That you're absolutely right. Outside Iran, we have an international organized movement that is working to basically form the policies, the right policies in the West. The policies of, you know, closing eyes on the atrocities that are going on in Iran, which we call the appeasement policy. This is not the right policy. This is a policy that did not work for the entire world when, you know, British were appeasing Hitler, thinking that he's going to sit back and there's not going to be any war. And the world ended up with a world war. It's the same type of mistake that the West is making in trying to control and appease the Ayatollahs. Inside Iran, however, there is a huge resistance movement that is leading everything. Our work outside the country is introducing the alternative to the Ayatollahs, not only in the form of the National Council of Resistance led by a woman, Mrs. Rajavi, and the plan that she has. And I appreciate you having put her plan on the website. It's a 10-point plan that, you know, General James Jones, a 4-star, you know, military person of U.S. Army, has called repeatedly a Jeffersonian plan for Iran. So the everything that we're doing is for the movement that is actually taking place inside Iran. Inside Iran, the young generation mostly, with the help of, you know, the activists from all ages have been organizing themselves in terms of what we call resistance units. You know, people, you know, everybody is heard of the resistance movement in France when they got rid of, you know, their dictators. And in Iran, we have the same type of thing. These are people who are getting together, forming small units that are getting ready to form the uprisings that will eventually topple the regime inside Iran. And these are the kind of things that are also happening in the Middle East, in the most important, or I should say the most critical country, one of the largest in that area with vast amount of oil and gas, with control over the Persian Gulf and all of those things that your listeners probably will just know by looking at the map. This country has its own resistance movement inside the country. It is a totally different picture from what the world had seen, let's say in Iraq or Afghanistan, where there wasn't an organized resistance inside. The difference is that with Iran, as we have said in our movement for many, many years, there is no need to send money or weapons for the people in Iran. They have their own might and will to take care of things. What is missing is not sending foreign boots to Iran. It's actually supporting the local boots on the streets, a resistance unit that are formed by Iran's main opposition group, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, which is known mostly in the social media as the Persian acronym MEK, Mujahideen Khalq, MEK. These resistance units that the MEK has inside Iran, they are the one that need the support. They are the one that need the political support more than anything else.
Hamid, weren't they? Hasn't the MEK been demonized over the years as the bad guys? Weren't they cast as the? I seem to remember this from before. We had had a conversation, and our government was trying to say that they were
I think they were on the terror watch list.
Yeah, weren't they the bad? They were being we were being told they were the bad guys.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the Bill Clinton administration, that Iran had elected a president. It wasn't an election because there's under dictatorships there is no election.
They
had selected a new president, and his name was Khatami, and he was leading the so-called reform in Iran. You know, the same problem that we had for many, many years, that the West thought that, oh, there might be a reformist within,
right,
within Iranian government, within all of these Islamic fundamentalism, there might be a reformer.
Right, an Islamic fundamentalist reformer, that's kind of funny.
I mean, exactly. It's like the giant shrimp, right?
Yeah. Is that I like that. That's fun.
Yeah.
On that happy note, I'm sorry I don't have a song about a shrimp or I'd play it. we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
No problem. We'll continue after the break.
With Hamid and Fred. Ponder that giant shrimp while you're thinking about it.
Ooh. can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing it.
So, back to the reasonable and well-organized and magnanimous Islamic fundamentalist reformers.
This is the Fred. I would like to add one more item to the resistance unit. Before, you know, Hamid explained about the resistance units, but also in Iran, the women are the leader, actually, right now for this uprising. And the reason is also this Islamic fundamentalists, they put so much pressure on the women as a second citizen. And that's why, you know, they become the leader and they got so much energy. And I think there is a good chance that this revolution goes through. It will be the first time, I think, the women are making revolution. And it makes sense because there is the women, they need more freedom in that area, you know, because of what's happening to them. And the good news is about also resistance units, you know, over time, the uprising happening, they are realizing they are not gaining anything from the Iranian regime, Iranian government. Therefore, they become more radical and more radical, and that's why they are forming more resistance units. And besides, not only resistance units, they are training themselves, they are connecting with each other, they are making very, very strong networks because they know for them to be able to function against the Islamic Guard, they need to be also very organized, very connection, and very much using all the experience they have from the past and to use it to practically to the next uprising as coming practical. I just want to add to Hamid's comment regarding to the resistance units in Iran.
So are we at the part where you can tell us about your events here? I don't know what your roadmap for us is. We've got plenty of time.
Yeah, so let me just go ahead and finish what we were talking about before the break, that it was the Bill Clinton administration that got excited about the prospect of reform in Iran, and what they did, they, at the request of the newly selected president in Iran, they put the movement, the MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq, and it was our movement on the terrorist list, and it took us 15 years, if I'm not mistaken, to take the case to the court of law in United States and have the courts order the government to remove this movement. So this was the depth of the appeasement policy and how far it went in not allowing, you know, the people of Iran to have their own fate and be able to make the regime change that they need to do. And we are seeing changes, as we talked about it before, that after October 7th, things are moving in a different direction, and people are realizing throughout different administrations in all countries that there is no place for the Iranian regime in the world anymore. And as I mentioned, the little by little, what we are trying to do through the rallies that we had yesterday, and we'll get to that too in a minute, is to send this message to everybody that look at all of the uprisings in Iran. Look at how yesterday was the fifth anniversary of the 2019 nationwide uprising in Iran. When we look at all of the news coverage by the Iranian regime during that uprising, there is a lot of indication that the regime came very close to getting collapsed. It was the beginning of a nationwide uprising that was led by the resistance units inside Iran, the MEK resistance units inside Iran. And there were talks of, you know, 1,000 different points of fighting back and forth between people and the repressive forces throughout Iran, showing the fact that the movement in Iran was ready, is ready, and capable of making the change. But just the fact that it did not become the 5 o'clock news in U.S. shows that the policies that were governing the mainstream media did not want everybody to know that, you know what, in Iran there are kids in the street, they are fighting their own fight, and they want to topple the regime and bring about a democratic system. Let's support them. That did not happen. And that is the big thing that is missing in the picture for the Iranian people. Just the fact that people are not realizing. So our rallies, like the one that happened yesterday in San Francisco, they had the same sister organizations in Southern California. They had the same kind of thing in Santa Monica. There are sister organizations in Washington, D.C. also had one in front of the White House. And everybody was basically chanting the same chants and asking the same thing, that it is time for the civilized world to stop appeasing the Ayatollahs, take some action through international bodies like United Nations to put some pressure on Iran to stop the massive wave of executions. Iran has selected a new president, and in the last 4 months, you know, his first 100 days of being in the office, there has been over 460 executions in Iran. Wow. At least, as far as I know, 15 were women. Now, these are horrible, horrible data that is coming out of Iran. And when we hear that, you know, the current administration is talking about, you know, going back to the negotiations table with the same regime, worried about, you know, whether or not they're going to have a nuclear bomb, which is a valid worry. But it's not the right policy. And our events, our rallies are basically pointing out the facts about Iran, pointing facts about the fact that Iranian boots are on the streets. We need to support them so that we can prevent sending foreign boats to Iran to get rid of this evil regime.
Were the 400 executions you're talking about, were they all political executions?
Not necessarily. Some of them are for other so-called crimes, but most of them are political ones. Mm-hmm. And that's, these kind of executions are not really the extent of the atrocities that are going on. And in the same country that it is, there's so much corruption that they are, the government is left and right announcing billions of dollars that are being embezzled by its own throughout Iran, and there are quite a few number of billion-dollar embezzlements going on. A couple of weeks ago, two brothers who are from the Kurdistan region of Iran, they had their four right-hand fingers cut off they were caught for some petty theft. And international bodies, you know, made statements about it, you know, condemned it, and so on and so forth. But these kind of things have been going on in Iran for four decades. You know, the vicious form of punishment like this has been going on in Iran for many years. And one of the points that we want to make across to the governments is that you should not sit down and talk with people like this. When people are in the street shaking their lives and chanting death to the dictator, I give my life for Iran, those are the kind of things that should be supported. And at the moment, they have not been supported amply, and there hasn't been, especially in the last 4 years, has not been, you know, the proper maximum pressure that needs to be put on the Ayatollahs. Yeah.
And another factor also, most of the execution also is from the Kurdish area. With the Kurdish area, they have, you know, for a long time, they have a problem. There's a lot of uprising in that area. And also from the east side, Baluchis also. For the high percentage of the execution from these two areas. And also, if you look at the age-wise, the execution, usually Iranian government, they focus on the young people because that's when they want to cause more fear. Therefore, there is a list for them, therefore, as they need, therefore, they start executing. Sometimes, it's average about 4.5 per day, but sometimes in 3 days, they execute 35 people within 3 days. I mean, the way they do it, they just want to cause more fear, practically.
So, the resistance fighters, we talked about not really needing boots on the ground and so forth. Are they getting any support from other nations, or are they pretty much in this alone?
No, they are pretty much in this alone, Bill. And they have the support of 80 million Iranians inside Iraq, right? So by nature, these resistance units are groups of people that are basically getting organized and getting ready to fight their internal enemies. And they live in the neighborhood that people know that they are part of their resistance units. And if anybody, you know, searches the resistance units in Europe, it's the same kind of things that, you know, people know who they are, people support them, people give them help, and that's exactly why and how they can take actions inside different cities in Iran pretty much in daylight and in the, you know, observation of people that are living in that neighborhood. One point in case that I bring up a lot is, you might remember the Iranian IRGC external group, the Quds Force in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani was his name. He was taken out in one of his trips in Iraq by President Trump's administration. And it was a huge blow to the Ayatollahs. It derailed a lot of things that the Ayatollahs did in the Middle East. And, of course, the Ayatollahs wanted to make a national hero from him. So in one of the cases, they made a 2-meter, which is like 6-7 feet tall statue of him, and they put it in the one of the roundabouts in a major city in, if I'm not mistaken, it was in southern part of Iran.
Guys, we have to jump off for the news here. Terribly sorry, but we will be
no problem.
Right,
we'll continue
back
after the news.
Be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio.
.us.